It's July 20th, 2016, and welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's science and technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. First up, we will cover the local tech calendar. Lindsay Wilbur from the Future Studies program at UH will tell us about the next Tech for Good meetup. Then Matthew Romaine from the City and County of Honolulu's Department of Emergency Management will tell us about an upcoming CERT class.
And finally, after the break, we'll look ahead to the commercial applications of unmanned aerial systems. Joining us is Ted Ralston and Mike Elliott, and we'll cover the recent rule changes approved by the FAA following allowing commercial use of drones.
What qualifications and restrictions will be in place, and what business opportunities can be found in the skies? We, of course, welcome your comments and questions as part of that conversation. You can call in or send us a tweet after the break.
And, of course, we want to get right into some of our, let's say, upcoming events. And we want to welcome Lindsay Wilbur from the UH Future Studies. And she's here to tell us about this upcoming Tech for Good meetup. And, of course, how we can use future studies with collective impact to benefit our communities. Welcome to the show, Lindsay.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit first off about this this Tech for Good meetup. I know it's been around for a little while. It sort of went on a little hiatus. And one of your buddies, our buddies, Joe Heao Kulani, is kind of reviving it, right?
He is.
Yeah. So tell us a little about the meetup.
Yeah, it's really exciting. So it's actually part of a larger organization. It's Tech for Good, also called Net Squared.
Mm-hmm.
And this is started by TechSoup Global, which is an organization in San Francisco that works with nonprofits and technology companies to bring tech solutions to different industries and nonprofit sector as well. And they have different meetups in over 60 cities across the United States. And these different organizations can be found on Facebook as well. So there's a lot of information sharing between cities. And it's been around for about 11 years now. So it has a long track record of doing good and bringing people from different sectors together with different kinds of expertise mm-hmm. to think about collective action.
When you say tech for good, what mm-hmm. sort of tech are we talking about?
It can be all different sorts of technology. It can range from different kinds of, computer programs or applications that nonprofits can use to run their organizations internally. Or it can also mean, different ways of telling their story, of a nonprofit telling their story and, gaining public awareness or outreach. Through technology, it can also be a way to come together to deliberate and discuss or share data as well, or collect data.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, this sounds like this organization has a long history, certainly very broad range in terms of, as you said, different kinds of technologies that can be applied to, I would imagine, different good causes. Could you give us an example of what maybe a signature project of this sort of longstanding civic tech organization has done?
Sure. So one is something called SafeNight app. And oftentimes, so you just asked me what kind of technologies
sure.
are used. But really, it's about finding the need and really talking to the people who are in the field and who are getting their hands dirty and who are really out there on the streets, pounding the pavement and doing the work with the people directly. And so it's really about going and figuring out what their needs are. So SafeNight app was looking at the sort of domestic violence housing, so emergency housing, and finding a way to have people who want to help out and want to do good, but maybe don't necessarily have the time to volunteer, but they want to help somebody who's really in need. So what it is an app that people can donate a room, and this app will then work with the service provider, the nonprofit, and they'll be able to connect the person in need with a hotel room that's prepaid for by somebody, could be around the world, who's using this app and wants to help out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one example of something that's come from these meetups.
Mm-hmm. And right. How about locally? I mean, I would imagine mm-hmm. you in your own mind have a number of imagined, best case scenarios. Are any you can share?
Mm-hmm. I know that there's a lot of exciting, opportunities around open data and also around transparency, I think, in the state, and finding ways to, you know, meaningfully collaborate, even among, for example, the neighborhood boards, and trying to show what is, you know, being discussed, what are the major issues for the different neighborhoods. And I know that there's people who are thinking of, you know, ways to share these kinds of meetings or these kinds of discussions more widely. But then there are these different loopholes that have to happen. So it's really about people coming together to try to figure out, like, what is the need, and then how can we work within our governance scheme in terms of the neighborhood board setup to be able to share this data. And so that's something that really needs to be explored with not only the neighborhood board members, but then also, you know, people within our government, and then also trying to build that bridge between community too. So I know that's something, that's an area that people really want to work on, just because that's, I think, a great way to connect with local government. And of course, there's lots of other really interesting community mapping projects that are always happening. And I would say that really it's like about talking to different people and just bringing people in the room. I think around urban planning as well, there's mm-hmm. a lot that can be done too with that, that I think is untapped in terms of thinking of how as a community we can leverage our creativity to build something together that, you know, is lasting.
So Lindsay, you kind of come out of this future studies program. I mean, I know you're still mm-hmm. a part of it. How did you kind of hook up with the Tech for Good meetup folks? And what is it that you are trying to present, I guess, at the next upcoming meetup?
Yeah, so at this upcoming meetup, I want to talk a little bit about how thinking about the future is really something that can be leveraged for, you know, social good, and also for bringing people in different disciplines around a similar concept, because everybody thinks about the future. So it's something that is really, does really unify a conversation. And there's a lot, you know, of emotion and imagination and, you know, fear and hope, for example, that the future can elicit. And so by, you know, working with these different tools that mm-hmm. future studies can provide, it provides an opportunity to engage with the future in a really useful way, and to have these direct outputs as well too, such as you know, images from the future, artifacts from the future, and also doing things like community or not community mapping, but collaboratively, you know, reimagining different parts of the city, for example. Mm-hmm, what is this mm-hmm. going to look like in 15, 20 years? And we also have some of the climate change data, some of the sea level rise data. So looking at, you know, data that we have now to be able to think about different scenarios and build those scenarios, tell that story, but then take away from that story, you know, what it is we want to work on today in order to build a future together.
Now, at this meetup for Tech for Good, what would somebody expect? Do you come and you immediately dive into code? Are you sticking post-it notes all over the wall? I mean, what is a typical event like? What can someone look forward to if they want to participate from the tech angle to help a civic cause?
Yeah. So, I mean, yes, definitely. There will be post-its all over the place and lots of markers. Well, people from, you know, all industries are welcome. And it's really something that if you have a skill that you want to teach somebody, if you have a skill that you want to learn, you know, come with those ideas. And it's, you know, pretty open format. So we will be doing introductions, sharing a little bit about why we came and what it is we want to do. I think it's a great opportunity for people who are not so familiar with technology to get their feet wet and to start thinking about, you know, how this technology that we see around us can, you know, really be integrated into our lives in a way that is going to make our lives better. And that's something that I think we all are, you know, see challenges sometimes trying to organize our lives. And so it's really this good time to get together and to share what works, what doesn't work.
So it's not like you need to have a coding background to be a part of this.
You don't need to have a coding background.
And you mentioned a little bit about some of the tools. So I would imagine that if somebody were to attend this meetup, they would get exposed to some of the basic tools of sort of future thinking and future studies.
Every Tech for Good event, there will be a different expert or, you know, person who has different skills, and they'll be able to share what they know and then, you know, ask questions and, of course, hear from other people who've come what they know, too. So it's, you know, there will be sort of these, keynote speakers mm-hmm, mm-hmm. every event, and it will be different. However, it is a good opportunity if you, you know, want to see something shared or discussed. We're more than happy to take suggestions as well.
So are you also now part of helping Joe out with sort of managing and organizing future meetups?
Yeah, I'd love to. I really think the event is very special because it does bring together technologists with people who are working in nonprofit or, you know, in government or in academia to, you know, just come together around, you know, creative imagination. Mm-hmm.
So if somebody wanted to participate, one more time, where and when is this next meetup and where can they find more information?
Yeah. So on Facebook, Tech for Good or HNL Tech for Good is how to find us. And our event is listed on hnl.io. Mm. So it's an upcoming event. And this upcoming event will be at Manoa Innovation Center. And the time is from 6 to 8, although we might extend it a little bit later. And people can find Manoa Innovation Center online as well. Mm-hmm. All the instructions
are
there.
And this is taking place on Tuesday, the 26th.
July 26th, yeah.
Very good. We'll put the link up on the show notes later on tonight.
Thanks.
Well, thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Sorry. Thanks, Lindsay, for joining us. And, of course, next up, we have Matt Romaine from the City and County of Honolulu's Department of Emergency Management. And he's here to tell us about a CERT refresher course. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hey, what's up, guys?
So first off, tell us, Matt, what is CERT?
So CERT stands for Community Emergency Response Teams. The acronym is CRT. The whole purpose of CERT is so that individuals and communities can work together in the absence of first responders, should there be a hurricane, earthquake, flood, anything like that. So it's really it's proactive in getting the community to really, I guess, work for themselves rather than sit around and wait for assistance.
Right. So, I mean, for example, a lot of people might get first aid training or CPR training, maybe involved with their place of employment, but sometimes just because they want to be the person who is prepared anywhere they happen to be to assist in case of an emergency. So CERT kind of creates these networks of volunteers who just want to be ready and prepared to, you know, not necessarily take any official action, but just be helpful and to help provide information in a neighborhood, say, Mililani or Manoa or wherever you happen to be, if in an emergency there's anything cutting them off from official sources.
And something like this is extremely important in neighborhoods like Makaha or Waianae.
True.
Should there be anything to block the road there, you know, it's one way in, one way out, right? And if there's like a downed pole, you don't know how long it's going to take for firefighters or EMS to get there, fight through traffic, clear the debris. So if you've got like a community of CERT-trained individuals, they have a much, much better chance of surviving or getting through whatever hardship they're facing at the time.
Mm-hmm. So what are the components of CERT training? We should mention both Bert and I got to go through this program, and it's pretty fascinating, very remarkable, and very memorable.
So the CERT training refresher event that we're going to be having is kind of – it's geared more so towards the people that have already took CERT training already. Ah. But, you know, if you want to come out and get trained, then, you know, right on. That works too. We're going to be doing – 3 stations at Leeward Community College in a round-robin format. So we'll have all the volunteers broken up into 3 groups, and they'll do 1 station each for give or take an hour or so. These stations will be disaster medical, which is, you know, disaster first aid. So, you know, what would it be?
How would you maybe stop the bleeding or that kind of metal?
Yeah, that kind of stuff. We're not doing like tourniquets or nothing extreme like that.
Okay,
you know?
Okay.
But, you know, real first aid medical. The second station we're going to have will be like kind of light search and rescue.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want anyone really endangering themselves. But, you know, should there be someone trapped in some kind of debris, we give you a good idea of how to get in and get them out, leveraging, cribbing, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third event that we're going to be having is fire suppression. So we'll have different mm-hmm. types of fire extinguishers and a safe fire source that we can all practice aiming and shooting these fire extinguishers at.
So this is a refresher class. So it is the assumption that everybody has already gone through kind of the 4 weekends of the full-on CERT, CERT certification. Is that correct?
Yes.
This sort of, I think it's like a one-day event. You can go from one work area to another and sort of get exposed, just kind of, like you said, refresher of all these different topics.
Yes, yeah, because the problem with CERT is a lot of times we'll train individuals and then they don't use the skills for 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
Sure.
So this is definitely a good refresher. But, you know, at the same time, if there's people that haven't gone through CERT, they can come out too. It's like watching a you know, like a movie number two or number three. You don't necessarily have to watch the first one to enjoy the second or the third.
The sequels are still entertaining.
So you can come out. You're definitely going to learn. We're not going to tell you no, but it is kind of more so for the people that have taken cert. And it's a good way for them to refresh and practice their skills. That way they don't lose that skill set.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to talk a little bit about that original program, though? I mean, is it still ongoing? It's still available?
The original cert program?
Yeah. Yes. To go through that.
Yep. That's definitely still going on. Our guy that teaches it at the city, his name is Jeff Spencer. He's the volunteer coordinator, and he's got a lot of other volunteer instructors, too. We've got about 40 instructors, but at the moment, only 10 of them are active. So at Leeward Community College, when we have this refresher event, you can we'll expect about 8 instructors. But yeah, no, Jeff teaches CERT once a month. Well, not once a month, but he teaches it every month. It's about a 3 or 4 weekend long course. You go in one day of the weekend. The first few weekends will be academic. You'll be watching PowerPoints and you'll be learning that side of it. And then the last event will be the actual practitioner of the skills that you guys learn in the classroom.
And I think that that practical, where you do it up at Diamond Head still?
Yes, Diamond Head.
Is still, you know, I think certainly memorable, where they use a bunker and they set it up as a disaster scene, including sometimes smoke, certainly no lights, and there are injured people positioned there, and you have to practice all your skills to access the space safely, not get injured yourself, and locate, and you do triage, determining if someone else should help someone or if you can help them. And it's definitely memorable.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I took away from that is trying to approach the disaster response in a somewhat organized manner. Like if there is a down building, perhaps it could be a house, you know, next door. How do you organize the people that are around you to perhaps go in and triage, you know, whoever might be hurt in that building? It's not like, okay, you know, let's all rush the building, right? So it's a way of organizing the resources that you have available. So part of, I think, CERT training and this refresher is being kind of in that leadership role, so that when something does happen, people are looking around themselves like, okay, who's going to make the first move? Well, you're at least prepared to do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, CERT definitely puts you in that situation. And like you were saying, it's dark. There's a lot of smoke. And the smoke compared with the darkness, if you try to turn a flashlight on, you're just looking at smoke. So it's really good to be able to do it in a controlled setting rather than having to do it your first time in an actual setting, you know.
And I guess the good thing is that if we don't use this for the next 3, 4, 5 years, I mean, that's a good thing because there hasn't been a disaster. But at the same time, it's great to have sort of these refresher courses that are offered.
Mm-hmm.
So give us the details, where, when, and how can people sign up?
So August 6th, we'll be at Leeward Community College. It starts at 8, so try to be there at 7:50, we ask. Just park in the main lot, parking's free. And the link for the registration, it's an Eventbrite page. We have the link on the Oahu Department of Emergency Management Facebook page. So you can look up Oahu DEM, and we've got a link right there to the Eventbrite page.
Great.
And that's the only thing I could use a refresher.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to go, I'll go, because I think I need a refresher. I mean, I'm glad we haven't been able to use this, but it's still good to have, you know, sort of like
get it updated.
Yeah, top of mind. Anyway, thanks, Matthew, for joining us.
Thank you.
And of course, we'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be joined by Ted Ralston and Mike Elliott to talk about commercial drone use.
It's been a year since these two great experts had last joined us. How much has really changed in those 12 months? We'll find out, you know, what constitutes commercial drone use. We'd, of course, love your thoughts or questions as part of the conversation. I'm sure you will have them. You can call 941-3689 or reach us toll-free from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689.
And, of course, we're actively monitoring Twitter. You can tweet us your questions at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Hi, this is Ray Cruz inviting you to join me tonight from 8 to 10 for Latin Beat. I'll be playing classic Afro-Cuban Latin jazz, Latin big band classics, and share the latest releases in Latin jazz. That's Latin Beat tonight from 8 to 10 here on HBR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. See you tonight.
This year's musical fundraiser at the Poly Coop is a celebration of the Hawaii in Hawaii Public Radio. New music created for each island by Kuana Torres Kahele, danced to by Mary Monarch winning Halau, the art of the lei, and Ono Hawaiian food. Join us for the day or just one of the two concerts featuring music for the Hawaiian Islands. And bring five of your friends to enjoy a group discount. Let us tell you more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Whole Foods Market Hawaii, Ulupono Initiative, and Hawaii Pacific University.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And joining us today are Ted Ralston and Mikey Elliott. Ted is an ex-aerospace industry executive and, of course, a well-respected consultant on unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, or UASs.
Mike, meanwhile, retired from the U.S. Navy after serving for nearly 23 years. He's the co-founder of Drone Services Hawaii, which sells services and even builds drones and custom search and rescue drones. He's constantly motivated by the devastation he still sees in the Asia Pacific region.
And of course, how does one get a commercial drone pilot's license, and what does it mean to be commercially certified? We'd love to hear your questions and comments. And that number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu, or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We want to welcome you both to Bite Marks Cafe.
Thanks a lot, Bert and Ryan.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate coming back.
Welcome back. You know, I was looking at my calendar. We had you guys like 1 year ago. And, of course, you guys are like the dream team on drone activity in Hawaii. Now, let's start with Mike. And, of course, Ted, you can also chime in here. But what has happened over this last year since we last had you on?
Well, a tremendous amount. The FAA was under a lot of pressure to come out with a new rule set that actually governed how commercial drone operations were going to be conducted.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what was released here recently under this Part 107 rule set. Formerly, it was a 333 exemption process that was necessary for commercial drone operations. And really what it was an exemption from the rules, basically saying, we really don't have any rules.
So
we're
going to
create
you,
a process, and here's the rules that we're exempting you from. Some of the silly things as to the size of the numbering that you had to have, like aircraft numbering. There was nothing that allowed you to put small numbers on a drone. They had a minimum standard. So they had to come up with a rule set. And that was what people have been operating under for about 2 years or so now. Now with this 107 rule set, the biggest thing that was awaited for that was the lack of requirement to have a private pilot's license. That's what was the key element in a 333, that you had to have a private pilot's license minimum to actually be the pilot in command for a drone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's gone, and then there's a few other elements to it that are pretty good too.
And how recently were these new, this 107, for example, introduced?
This is just a few weeks ago. At the end of June, it came out, and right now it doesn't take effect until the 29th of August. That's when the first test, you can take the first exam for that, and that's going to be an FAA test, given at one of the test centers around the country. We have one here in Hawaii. It's a CATS test center that you have to sign up for the exam, pay for it. It's $150. Take the test. It's $150 if you fail it again to come back. So it's not easy either. It's more along the lines of a sport pilot's license.
You know, I want to hear a little bit more about the pilot's license is like and how you have to get that. But it also says on the FAA.gov website, it says that it will be in effect on August 29th, 2016. So,
right.
Yeah, it's like this is brand spanking new.
And, you know, there's something to think about in that regard. The FAA has been under a lot of pressure, a lot of criticism from around the country, around the world for some time. But now it's elevated itself above and is the apple of the eye of the rest of the world. This particular rule set and the latitude it provides and the waivers that are implicit in it for getting even more latitude is a very well thought through rule set. So the rest of the world is taking a look at this and saying, you guys went from the bottom to the top in a couple of weeks here.
So can you share a little bit about perhaps that process? I mean, who spent the time to
think
through
this?
That
is a really good question, Bert. You know, the whole process is in the FAA is based on legacy experience. So you gain experience and you get some good ideas and you pass them on to the next rule and you eliminate those things that don't work. So what's happened is the 333, as Mike talked about, the experience in the 333 exemption world allowed the 107 to exist. And the world of public aircraft operations that preceded that allowed the concept of non-certified aircraft to be employed. So that one learns from the other. In fact, a good pointer to be made is that just as the commercial utility of the UAS is now allowed by this new rule, in parallel to that, what's called public aircraft operations, which is where you public agencies and such can use UAS and operations, that's increasing in its capability in a parallel manner. So the two are going in the same direction and are feeding each other. It's a quite incredible process to see it play out.
And I can imagine there was a backlog of Section 333 exemption requests, which, again, was already an imperfect sort of framework. So to be able to learn from that to create what this new framework would be must have taken a lot of effort on the FAA's part.
Yeah, there were something like 34,000 comments that had been received on the proposed rules, and every one of those had to be looked at, adjudicated, and compared, and categorized, and counted or discarded. So that's quite a thorough process, and it's a great credit, I think, to the rulemaking system around here.
So what the rules are trying to do, too, is to drones, small UAS systems, right now are visual line of sight systems, pretty soon in the very near future, beyond line of sight capability and others. You're having to operate in the national airspace under the same set of rules as manned aviation. You have to speak the same language. You need to be able to read a VFR sectional chart and understand the airspace that you're operating in. So if you're operating by that rule set, you have to be knowledgeable in that arena to be able to operate properly. And that's really what they're after, is that integration into national airspace and that awareness of operators so that they are not a hazard to manned aviation.
Mm-hmm. I can see how you might say that, like, the new 107 rules with the test and the real existing design framework for commercial operations is an improvement. I'm curious how things had been under the Section 33 waiver setup. I mean, will people who are operating with those Section 333 exemption from the rules find their lives more or less complicated under the 107 framework?
Well, from what we understand, you can grandfather – well, the 333s are going to be grandfathered in. You can still operate under it until it expires. Or you can transition over and just start 107 operations. And then if you need various waivers, you can ask for those particular types of waivers. We have a particular contract coming up in the very near future that requires night flight. You can get a waiver to fly drones at night, and there's a way to do it. So it's just filing for that type of exemption to be able to do it. We've done a number of COAs that allow us to fly inside of 5 miles of airports. Hmm. There's a process by which you do that. And it's a coordination between the FAA and then also the air traffic control manager at that particular airport to come up with a rule set, a time and a place and a location when you can safely operate. So there's ways to do this properly. It just takes time.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
That's what some people who don't want to follow the rules that are causing some of the problems, they just don't want to take the time, the effort, and they just go out and do
want
to do.
I mean, part of that is because you can just go on Amazon, buy a drone, and receive it and start flying it, right? And you spoke a little bit about the pilot's license. What would let's say
now only for commercial operations? A hobbyist does not require any type of license. Just the registering of the drone on the FAA's website as a hobbyist. Yes.
Okay. So if you want to now venture into the commercial realm, you have to go and get this pilot license. And so is this some of the classes that you're offering?
Well, what we did, I have a certified flight instructor we've worked with in developing a course to help train to the test. The test itself costs $150 to take. It's administered by the FAA. There are practice exams with sample questions that are out there. And it looks very much like a sport pilot's license test. When you look at some of the questions that are in there and understanding folks that have operated drones, we know that a lot of them don't understand airspace issues, communication issues, things that are going to be on the test. Mm. So we put together a course as a prep course to help pass this test. We're having our first one this weekend here on Oahu, and then we're going to be going over to Maui and the Big Island doing it over there also.
And it's not like a ham radio test where all the questions are multiple choice. They're freely available. Anybody can drill on them and even just memorize the answers. It's a little more complex than that.
Well, they don't make the actual exam available. They make sample questions available, but you can't answer all the questions in advance and then go take the test.
There's an important point here that, that rides on top of the issue of the exam and such. Basically, the exam is like learning a language. This is the whole game of getting in from where we are today into the commercial operation through a 107 certificate is like learning a new language. It's the language of aviation, in this case, the low-altitude aviation, but still it's a commitment on your part of intellectual capital, and you got to put some money forth, and there's some risk. Mm-hmm. And so people who are in this game or are thinking about it are going to have to make a choice, either learn the language and take the test and pass it, or hire a service to do the work for you. And I think there will be a lot of people who just aren't going to want to put the effort forth to go get the training and get the certification. Yeah. It's going to be easier for them to go hire a service to get
and
the work done.
And that's one of the things that we've been doing over the past year, you know, is operating commercially. We've learned quite a lot, but we also know how to do it. So when somebody asks for a particular type of capability, we know kind of right away whether or not it's something within our grasp of equipment. We need, you know, airspace issues. We know what all those issues need to be resolved so that we can properly do the job.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Now, Ted, you know, in terms of commercial use, and let's say you're a startup, you're thinking of getting into this business, what would be some of the categories of commercial use that come to your mind?
The things that are probably going to be most interesting right up front are going to be real estate photography, environmental photography, mm-hmm. things that are calendar art, things like that that sell and that people want the new orientation, the new point of view, and the new insight that comes from the aviation perspective of from above. So I think that's where you'll see the biggest use of the 107 action. What do you think, Mike?
And we see it, you know, at the other end, too. Issues with regard to agriculture is a big one. There are inspection capabilities that drones provide with certain types of cameras, whether it's thermal camera systems or with near-infrared camera systems or even some hyperspectral systems that are available that have been shrunk down to the size that, you know, these drones can carry these around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, farming is one great example where the simple understanding of this is that you can fly a near-infrared camera system and determine better determine where you need to maybe put fertilizer, maybe where you've got a pest infestation or where the crop's not being watered properly. Well, above in a normal photograph, everything kind of looks okay. But you can better see the health of your crop. And farming is such a small margin. If you can put this type of tool into a farmer's hands and he can get out there and fly every so often and make these minor adjustments in his crops, then that's more money in his pocket. That's less pesticides in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those are some of the things that really come into play. And we talk to people of drones more as a tool, not something unique, but it's just a tool. And that's how they should start to view it in their daily lives.
Well, whether it's for farming, certainly something that I've become more and more interested in. And as you mentioned, real estate, I can also still see that perhaps a farmer might not necessarily need to or want to go through the process of taking the test and getting some certified. So I see that it creates these opportunities for service providers. Ted, in my day job at Hawaii Information Service and MLS, people are frequently asking us about drones and drones for real estate. Up until now, doing it commercially, hiring somebody was not technically allowed unless you were working with someone with the Section 333 exemption and a pilot's license. So now we're at this point where this framework exists. I might be a broker and I might say, hey, I think I want to invest in having one of my agents or one of my office people become the designated drone pilot and to go through this process. I mean, does that seem plausible to you? Is it still going to be intimidating, or is it something that you can see perhaps different offices and businesses in different industries kind of picking a subject matter expert and shepherding them through the process?
I think if you have a person in the office who has the aptitude and the interest in something like that, out of a group of 10 people, it shouldn't be hard to find somebody who can qualify. You mentioned amateur radio before and things like that. So there's a lot of similar activities we all are part of in our lives, and I think it wouldn't be hard to find someone who could then take that on in an office of 10 people.
And then, Ted, you know, in terms of a business making that decision to put the investment into somebody actually going through the certification, how much would you say that company would need to invest in order to get to that point of, you know, being certified?
Interesting question. That's the old make-buy question that every mm-hmm. industry is involved in. And I would guess I'll ask Mike for an opinion because he is very close to this as well. But probably $5,000 to $10,000 would be a reasonable thing to think about in terms of an initial investment to get you some initial.
And then you're thinking of equipment, you're thinking of classes, you're thinking of tests. I mean, and all together is probably somewhere between $5,000 to $10,000.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably easily get started. You know, $5,000. I think that was a reasonable investment. And that's not necessarily all up front, but you could start out there. And it depends what type of systems you want to. So once again, a drone, like I said earlier, it's kind of just a tool. But think of it also as a truck. The bed of your truck can haul all kinds of stuff, whether you load it up with asphalt or you're hauling, your neighbor's furniture off, to the dump or bringing home a Christmas tree. Drones are very much the same way. It's all about the payload. And it's also about the software that you process the data that you receive from this drone. So those two pieces of it are kind of forgotten sometimes when they think about these tools. And, people need to understand, when they ask for something, what format do you want it in? And when I ask that question sometimes, they're kind of, they don't know what they really should be asking. Mm-hmm. So the type of payload that you're carrying and the type of processing that you're looking for from the output product is key to, once again, if somebody's going to be starting a business or doing this, they need to have that full 360 solution of tools available to them.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Ted Ralston and Mike Elliott, both experts in drones and maybe venturing into the commercial arena of drones. And if you have a comment or question, feel free to give us a call. Number is 941-3689 on Oahu, or from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Now, in terms of, let's say, you're putting together classes. You're saying it's about somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. There have been a lot of pretty nice footage being shown on social media. What is your take on how much, perhaps, business formation is now taking place in Hawaii? Are they knocking down your doors? Is it
is it a gold rush?
Is it a gold rush?
I think when the 107 rules came out and stuff, first of all, people were like, hey, I think this is a good thing. They weren't quite sure what was in the rule set itself and what it really meant. We've been in discussion with a number of local businesses who want to incorporate drones into their some of the daily work that they do. Construction is one of those industries where drones have shown great benefit. Mm-hmm. A company called SkyCatch has worked very closely with construction firms in Korea and Japan, where they have drones out on site every day. And they're actually collecting all this data on site on these large construction sites. And they're able to fix problems and identify them before they become huge problems. And you can share information collaboratively worldwide. So an engineer in Germany who designed a piece of equipment for a project in Korea, they can see it. And they can actually build a 3D model, manipulate it, look at it, have a discussion. Hey, is this right? Is this supposed to go here? Vice picking up the phone or typing out an email and trying to attach a photo. Mm-hmm. So it becomes an integral tool to daily operations for construction. And we're seeing more of that overseas. And we hope to see more of that here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. I am kind of excited by the idea of the test in the sense that, and it might have been Ted that had mentioned this, with the Section 333 exemption process. Certainly, if someone had a sport pilot's license, you would imagine there's some qualifications and testing that goes into that. But to request an exemption largely required someone who could write a very good proposal, perhaps even taking ideas from other proposals, cutting and pasting and coming up with a perfect proposal that the FAA would review and then give you an exemption, and then you take off with your drone. It sounds like the barrier at least now is more knowledge-based in the sense that it's not about the request drafting something and having it approved, but it is basically demonstrating your familiarity with the terminology and the world of aviation.
I think that's probably true. And the other factor that goes behind those exemptions you're speaking of is that they were based on the argument of equivalent safety. So the exemption you're asking for is the exemption from the rules that let you operate, because the idea you have generates a greater, more safe operation in general. So the proof was really how well you can write and argue your story that the proposal you've got is going to be safer in net than running with a manned aircraft. But that's the argument that allowed the exemptions to occur. Now, in the case of the 107, it's a different set of logic. Now you're learning how to operate as an airman. You're learning how to operate with the other things that are operating in the air today, and the safety is now transferred to that kind of a thinking rather than the equivalent safety argument in the past. So there's two different doctrines, mindsets, you might say, that are underlying those two approaches.
You know, I want to hear Mike and Ted about, you know, if you think that there is something unique about Hawaii's position that perhaps gives us an advantage in the building of a commercial drone business. Want to hold that thought? We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation with both Ted Ralston and Mike Elliott about the potential for commercial drone use.
And of course, we'd love to hear from you as well. 941-3689 is the number to call, or from the Neighbor Islands, that number is 877-941-3689. You're listening to Bite Marks Cafe.
At the turn of the century, America caught bicycle fever.
Many of the same reasons that America becomes a car country are the same reasons that America first becomes a bicycle country. This notion that one could travel wherever he or she wished, whenever he or she wanted to.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason. Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
His debut album won 6 Hoku Awards, and his recently released second is full of mele and memories of people and places he loves. On July 23rd in the Atherton studio, experience Hawaiian music played in the real new style by Hoku Zudermeister. Tickets at hprtickets.org or at 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. And we're talking to Ted Ralston and Mike Elliott, two preeminent experts in the area of unmanned aerial systems, or drones.
And of course, you can give us a call. That number is 941-3689 on Oahu, or 877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands. Right before the break, we were sort of prepping it all up with the idea of what is it about Hawaii that could perhaps uniquely position it to, you know, advance this this business of commercial drone use? You know, we had the director of DBED on several weeks ago talking about potential, let's say, accelerators that would help maybe some of the startups in this area, and he was interested in aerospace and things like perhaps drone and these aerial systems that could perhaps spawn a whole new business. Yeah. Mike, what do you think? I mean, is there a new opportunity for Hawaii?
I think so. I mean, what we're looking at is the next technological revolution. You know, the way that aviation changed the world, the way that automobiles changed the world, the internet, you know, computer, personal computers, and things that at one point you just, why would I don't need that. I live my life without it. I'm fine. You cell phones. I mean, find somebody that doesn't have one,
mm-hmm,
all right,
mm-hmm,
running around chasing Pokemon now.
Exactly.
I know, right? But really where we're at is, like I said, the next technological revolution. Hawaii is a unique opportunity here where we could take advantage of this through you know, our educational system, whether it's all the way K-12, public or private, the university system, and be able to design, program, maybe some degree of building that could take place here in Hawaii. And, you know, I tell people when we have this discussion, and I sum it up with saying that there's no reason that Hawaii cannot be the Kitty Hawk of the Pacific. And when I say, you know, for this next technological revolution, we're uniquely tied, you know, to the west, through the islands, through Polynesia, all the way back to Japan, China, Australia, and through the South Pacific, and then also back to the mainland, the U.S. and stuff. We have this unique location here. We also have the weather. So when we're talking about drone testing, drone flying, you know, any type of projects, we really kind of have the weather and the environment that's very conducive to actually getting out there and flying a good portion of the year.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ted, Hawaii, as we've noted before, is part of a special FAA-designated testing area, including Alaska, and I think the University of Alaska is the lead agency on this. That certainly seems like one of the ways by which we can establish kind of a leadership role in the space. How is that partnership
going? You bet. That's
going?
Exactly right. In fact, that's up to us in Hawaii to figure out how to capitalize on that. What the FAA did is it selected a bunch of sites around the country that have uniquenesses about them. Hawaii, Oregon, and Alaska together were considered the extreme environment states. And so these the extreme environments are cold, of course, and wet. And out here we have the warm tropical environment. We have the steep mountains. We have the strong winds. We have the rain. So developing testing capabilities that allow potential drone manufacturers or drone systems to be tested to their limits is what we should be pushing on harder. Our challenge in Hawaii is to envision what uses of drones would most benefit Hawaii and also most challenge or are most challenged by the environment, and create programs that manufacturers would want to invest in terms of bringing their equipment out here for testing. Mm-hmm. But to the point you're making about business a minute ago, just to let everybody know, the same DBED organization you're speaking of is going to host a drone and UAS aerospace week the first week in October. Here at the Capitol, I think it's the 2nd to the 7th of October, if I'm not mistaken. And manufacturers, Mike, others will be there, and educators and such. And we're just putting together the plans for that right now. But the public can come down, interact with the drone manufacturers and such, and the legislators can as well.
Is that something that you can share with us and I can put up a link on it, or is that something that is
Jim Crisafulli put the flyer together this week. That's where we are.
Oh,
right
I
now.
See. So okay. Hot off the press.
Well, hot off the press,
there's
right.
There's a great point on that, too, and Steph. You know, what we've seen in a lot of locales in the U.S. and even somewhat here in Hawaii is an effort by legislators who think they need to legislate. And instead of letting the technology and the truth necessarily kind of come out and people realize that they maybe could make smart legislation, if any is even necessary at all. You know, there's been an uphill battle that, you know, the drone industry in general has been fighting.
Well, certainly there was always talk of privacy and drones. There was a infamous KITV segment where they could use drones to scope out your house to burgle it as if a giant object buzzing like a swarm of bees.
And you can drive your car by somebody's house to see if they're home, right? So, exactly.
You can put a camera on a mango picker and
get better pictures. Same thing, right? Same thing. So, you know, part of this is a fear-based misunderstanding of the technology. And anytime I have somebody who contacts me and has a negative comment or something, I ask them to come down to the store. I say, come by and see me. Let me show you what we can do. Mm-hmm. And let me show you what people are actually doing with these things every single day. There's always elements of misuse of any type of technology or any piece of equipment. I mean, right now between Bert and Ryan, they both have laptops sitting in front of them. Either one of them could easily just pick up that laptop and slap the other one upside the head. That's not what the
How
laptop
did you know
was intended for.
I'll cross that one.
Yeah. So you know, it's a misuse of a tool. And that's really what it is.
Well, Ted, you know, when we talked about opportunities, I think Mike also talked about the next generation and the future. The one that comes to my mind now that my daughter's going to UH-Hilo is they have a program there with drones and aerial systems, and they were applied to monitor the lava flow. And when you talk about extreme conditions, that and in interaction with an educational institution, that's a perfect intersection.
Certainly it is. In fact, to the credit of Ryan Paroi and the guys at UH-Hilo, Don Straney and company, that have put that all together, I just saw an article in the news today that they've been given permission to fly in a national park, and that is a really unique
almost
opportunity,
impossible.
And it's taken a lot of effort to get to that point. So that's all good credit on their part. And so your daughter's running right into the hotbed of UAS operations here in Hawaii, right there at UH-Hilo. But, you know, to the point of business again, Mike brought this up a minute ago, that miniaturization and small size components are characterizing the future of all this small drone business. And because the pieces are small, Hawaii is now able to produce things and manufacture them because shipping isn't so much a problem as it is with large components. So there's no reason Hawaii couldn't take a lead role in sensors, in the software that's used to analyze what the sensors collect, in the sense-making out of the information, out of the intelligence of it, and the expression of what you've now learned because you've collected some information on a drone. So for emergency operations, disaster operations, natural resources, tsunamis, fisheries, all those things that we care a lot about, They're right there in front of us, and it's our collective task to figure out how to generate research programs that take these to the next level.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, you know, what would you say to the person that says, hey, you know, you're going to fly a drone in over my house? That's my airspace. I can shoot that drone down, and you can't do anything about it.
Well, first of all, if you shoot down a drone, that's the FAA frowns upon that. It's actually against the law. It's federal law. You can't shoot down any aircraft. Drones are aircraft. Now, what people shouldn't do, and when we have customers, you know, they ask some of these kind of questions and say, well, what about my neighbor's house? And I said, well, would you do it with anything else? Would you get a ladder and some binoculars and go look into your neighbor's backyard, you know, while they're having a barbecue or in their pool? No, you wouldn't do it. So if you're not going to do it any other way, don't do it with a drone. And that kind of sums it up real quick right there. When they kind of make this equivalency of, oh, yeah, you're right, I probably shouldn't. You know, if you think you shouldn't, you probably shouldn't. And, you know, it's just those kind of common sense pieces, I think, that people have to get around. Now, the other side of it is people who don't, they see a drone and they think just because it's in the air that it's somehow
nefarious.
Yeah, doing something, you know. These things have wide-angle cameras on them. They're meant for very panoramic landscape type looks and stuff. And when we show people sometimes how close you have to actually be to see someone's face in very clear detail, they're very surprised. I mean, it's very, very close.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
and they're not quiet.
No.
Yet.
And as far as airspace, I mean, what is the airspace that you have in terms of your sense of ownership as a, let's say, homeowner?
Well, I guess there was a ruling in a case a long time ago that set it at something like 89 feet. It's an old case, many, many years ago and stuff. But, you know, the FAA explains airspace as from the ground, you know, to 63 miles is what they own.
Mm-hmm.
And then they actually can regulate something that flies through the airspace into outer space. So, you know, it's, I mean, they say they own all airspace. But I think when you're talking about, you know, privacy issues or respect for your neighbors and, you know, personal property, you know, exercising common sense.
It's common sense, yeah.
Which seems to be an uncommon virtue.
Right,
yeah, exactly.
is the best route. And if you wouldn't do it with any other piece of technology or any other way, then you shouldn't do it with
right,
drone.
I mean, you couldn't be, you know, you can't go into your neighbor's house with your, you know, trying to play Pokemon Go and think that, you know,
that's
it's okay.
Okay.
Because
yeah, just
because
there's
know.
One in his living room, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, Ted.
And these are all the emerging things that are going to be exposed and then resolved and solved and improved by virtue of the 107 rule set that's out there, just as 333 yeah. opened the door to the first level of commercial mm-hmm. operations.
I wanted to ask you, though, I mean, Bert brings up a good question. Counter drone
yes.
operations certainly seems like something that more and more people are curious about. Like, how do I stop a drone from interfering with my operation?
Interesting that you picked up on that term, because if we had Gretchen West sitting here who understands where the investment in the world is going towards drone-ism, she'd tell you that sensors and software and analytics, like Mike mentioned, is number one on the hit parade for where the business will be. Second is going to be counter drone, and third will be training. But counter-drone means the identification and the tracking, perhaps, and the understanding where something might have come from that that you may need to be active in a law enforcement role or in just protecting your own property role. For example, if you had one drone up over Honolulu today, nobody'd notice it. If you had 10, now we're going to get some calls to HPD, and HPD's got to figure out who these guys are. And are they legitimate? Is it HECO out there policing its substations? Is it somebody else looking at his own property or a farm or something? So we are going to have to deal with the issue of identification. And not different than that is the issue of what's your legitimate reason for being there. And I want to give a congratulations to Mike over here. He's done some video work recently, and everything has been properly labeled, proper legends, and even identification on the uniforms of the people. So it's really clear what they're doing. They're out there. They have FAA's approval for this particular operation, and the paperwork's right there. And that attitude is going to have to be passed to the other people as well, so that when you see a person running a drone, you can get quickly, if you're a law enforcement guy or just a person interested, what the legal status of that individual is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a good point. Real quick, I think that's something, you know, one of the things with this Part 107 rule set, and something that's been frustrating for a lot of folks that have worked very hard under the 333 process to operate legally, is enforcement. And hopefully with the 107 rule set, you know, the FAA giveth, and hopefully the FAA taketh away,
mm-hmm.
and that there is some level of enforcement to go after rogue operators and individuals who, while, like I said, had a 333 but never actually filed anything they were supposed to or even operated under it properly. Just like if you got a driver's license, you know, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden, hey, I got my driver's license and drive down H1 on a maybe at 3 in the morning, 180 miles an hour. It doesn't authorize you to do that.
Right,
but people
right,
would
right.
sit there and operate still in a manner that was not in accordance with the law. And if the FAA could actually do some level of enforcement under this new rule set, I think that would be very, very beneficial to enhancing a professional industry and a profession
mm-hmm.
where there was some level of support at that end.
Now, one of the areas that is growing and becoming more popular is the idea of drone racing.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to hear your opinion on if I am an organizer and I'm going to be giving out prizes to drone racers, is the active participation in this event commercial?
You know, I look at that from a completely different perspective. The drone racing is the first real example of purpose-designed drones. These things are designed for that exact purpose. They're designed to run into a tree or a mountain and come back ticking. They don't break. They just fold up and unfold them, and they're ready to go again.
Mm-hmm.
Very robust. They have extremely high performance margins for extremely high maneuverability. They can handle the winds here, no problem at all. They can climb vertically at probably 3,000 or 4,000 feet per minute, which means they really have a lot of performance. So in terms of even application to search and rescue, that technology is superbly oriented in that direction. Secondly, the cognition that the pilots go through in terms of how they receive two-dimensional information but they code it internally as three-dimensional is quite incredible. So we're seeing, I think, the first level of really novel technology and really novel utility in a purpose-designed domain, and that's what I see drone racing as. I think it has a lot of applications everywhere
else. Is there money to be made in drone racing? Yes. So if anybody's out there listening and you're interested in drone racing and you know, you're good at it, this October, Drone World,
Kualoa Ranch,
third week in October, all week long. There's going to be a Hawaii qualifying segment also, but we've sent there some folks recently that qualified to go to New York to compete in the Drone Nationals for the U.S., that are going to be in New York City here on Governor's Island. I think it's the 5th through the 8th of August.
It is considered commercial use.
It is, but right? They fly under AMA rule set. So that's how they operate.
Model aircraft.
Model aircraft. Right.
Uh-huh,
so that's
uh-huh.
how they've done this. That's how they've operated. And they haven't had any issues or anything with the FAA. Because
they're doing
a sanctioned event. Yes, there's money involved. But there also was at some point, too, with model aircraft. You know, before. So. The folks are saying, well, why are you making us different and saying this is commercial operations because potentially you're making money, prize money, you know, from winning an event. So it's all under AMA. They've got this all worked out. Come out in October, see some of the best people in the entire world that are going to be here on Hawaii that entire week. It's going to be live on ESPN. Mm. They've got a 3-year deal with ESPN. A lot of big sponsors are coming on board.
So, Mike, very quickly, if somebody was interested in your course on being prepared for the new 107 test, where can they go for more information?
So we've got listed on our Facebook page on Drone Services Hawaii, and there's also on our website in Drone Services Hawaii, too. Just type in 107 in the search, and we have our first class this weekend.
Fantastic.
Very good. We'll put that up on our show notes. Well, Ted Ralston is, of course, a UAV consultant, and Mike Elliott is a co-founder of Drone Services Hawaii. We want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we talk about emergency preparedness gadgets.
And, of course, if you miss any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. And if you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at feedback@bitemarks.org. And of course, you can always find us on Twitter. I'm at Bite Marks.
And you can follow me at Hawaii. Our engineer is David Chong, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And of course, we leave you with our song pick of the week. Here is Ricky Lee Jones. She's appearing at the Hawaii Theater on August 7th. And of course, the song is called Satellite. See you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.